I'd like to, with that, introduce our first speaker, Mark Sorrells, who's the head of the Plant Breeding and Genetics Department at Cornell University and a small grains breeder. He joined Cornell in 1978, a few years ago, after getting MS and PhD degrees at the University of Wisconsin.
Mark. Thanks a lot, Gary. It's a real pleasure to have an opportunity to present some of our work here today at this symposium to kind of kick off this week of meetings. I'd like to start by introducing, I don't actually have to introduce some of my co-authors here on this presentation. John Luke is going to be presenting his talk in this session also. I'd also like to introduce Nicola Heslow and Jessica Rutkowski. They're graduate students working with John Luke and I on genomic selection. All right. So I'm just going to quickly go through some work that we've been doing with genomic selection models, G by E, integrating genomic selection in a breeding program, some results of multifamily predictions, and then genomic recurrent selection. So crop improvement began with the hunter-gatherers who who practice mass selection to domesticate the species that we that became the crops that we use today. And clearly they were successful at improving these species with essentially no knowledge of the underlying genetic control of these traits. And then much later, along family selection methods, progeny testing methods were developed to increase heritabilities and gain from selection. And then today's focus is on tool development that taps into the power of molecular marker technologies. And more recently, the advent of genomic selection by the animal breeders has gained a lot of interest. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that today. But over time, for the most part, breeders have not really abandoned breeding methods, but instead integrated them and adapted them to new technologies and integrated them into new breeding strategies. In fact, Fisher's 1918 theory of infinitesimal variation is still applicable to breeding populations today. In molecular breeding, we're interested in discovering and characterizing new alleles, and in combining those superior alleles at different loci to effect transgressive segregation. We can increase gain from selection by increasing the accuracy of the selection, or increasing the selection intensity, or by reducing the selection cycle time. I'm going to quickly give an overview of the genomic selection technology. This breeding strategy uses two kinds of populations. The first population is a training population that is genotyped with a large number of markers and phenotyped for all of the important traits. In genomic selection, we use genome-wide markers, and they're considered to be random effects, and the effects on the phenotype are all estimated simultaneously. We are assuming that there is at least one marker in LD with each QTL affecting the trait. And our prediction model then attempts to capture the additive genetic variation and estimate breeding values of individuals based on the sum of those effects. Yep. The second population is the breeding population, and the breeding population is genotyped but not phenotyped. Instead, we calculate an estimated breeding value using our genomic selection prediction models. Now we can use that to impose multiple generations of selection. This figure illustrates how those two populations work together. Your training population consists of elite lines that are most relevant for the breeding population, and those are phenotyped and genotyped to train our prediction model. Then that prediction model is applied to the genotypes of our breeding population to estimate their breeding value and then select those best lines either for recycling into the crossing block or for moving them into advanced testing programs. And then once we've evaluated those materials, they can be recycled into our training population to update our model. There are a number of things that can affect the accuracy of our breeding values. The level and distribution of LD between the markers and the QTL is one. Mewison came up with a formula for calculating the minimum number of markers needed for cross-family predictions, and that's the effective population size times the size of the genome in Morgans. So for wheat, that would be somewhere around 1,500 markers. The size of the training population is also quite important, and in that same paper, Mewison estimated that you would need two times the effective population size times the number of Morgans, and so for wheat, that would be 3,000. And you'll see that we're using far smaller population sizes than that, and yet we're still able to get respectable prediction accuracies. Heritability also affects the accuracy. And then finally, the distribution of the QTL effects across the genome is important. So if you have many small effect QTL or low LD, then it tends to favor models that capture genetic relationship. However, that prediction based on relationship will decay faster than predictions that have markers in LD with the QTL. So we need to estimate many QTL effects from a very limited number of phenotypes. And if we use least squares regression, we quickly run out of degrees of freedom for our fixed effects in this model. And we also use an arbitrary threshold to do our variable selection. And this results in overestimation of these QTL effects and, of course, the loss of the sub-threshold effects. Instead, we can use linear mixed models or Bayesian models to estimate the QTL effects as random effects simultaneously. Different models have different assumptions, and they treat marker effects differently. Ridge regression best linear unbiased prediction assumes equal variance of all the markers, marker effects, and it shrinks the large QTL towards zero. Bayesian models, some of the Bayesian models use inverse chi-square distribution prior. The Bayes A calculates a different variance for each marker and uses all the markers, whereas Bayes B selects a subset of markers that are not equal to zero. And then finally, the Bayesian lasso model is more marker-specific. It shrinks the small effects more and the large effects less compared to the ridge regression. And then a couple other method models include the reproducing reproducing kernel Hilbert spaces regression.
Say that again.
This is based on a genetic distance and a kernel function with a smoothing parameter to control the distribution of the QTL effects. And then a model known as Random Forest is a machine learning model. It's based on a set of regression trees that are grown from samples of observations using a random set of predictors. And then those predictors are averaged across the trees. In all of these model comparisons, we're basing their performance on the correlation between the estimated breeding value and a true breeding value. That true breeding value is based on phenotype, and the correlation is analogous to the square root of the narrow sense heritability. So this is some of Nicola's work. He's in the audience, so if you have questions, I'll refer you to him. He compared 11 different GS models on 8 different data sets and based that comparison on accuracy, cross-validated GEBVs, kurtosis, and overfitting. In general, the models were relatively similar in their accuracy. The ridge regression, Bayesian lasso, WBSR, and random forest generally gave the best results. But there were differences in cross-validated GEBVs and marker effects. On the right is the cluster analysis for the marker effects, showing the relationship between the different kinds of models. You can see that the machine learning types of models group together and the Bayesian models group together. So they're obviously capturing accuracy with different kinds of marker effects. Another experiment that Nicola has recently been working on is to characterize environments by their allele effect estimates. And he used 58 different environments, nearly 1,000 S6 and S7 barley lines. And these test environments were spread across Europe. And he compared, and he used this, the Bayesian Lasso GS model. And the goal was to identify outlier environments and then group environments into mega environments. This is a heat map that just shows a cluster analysis of those marker effects for the different environments. And from this, on this heat map, you can see that the outlier environments really stand out, and the you can see the environments that are more closely related that are a darker blue color. So this gives you a kind of a visual representation of how those marker effects are similar or dissimilar in the different environments. But it didn't really result in an appreciable gain in the accuracy of the model from this this cluster analysis. Another approach to looking at G by E that Nicola has been working on recently is using the predictive ability of an environment to optimize the composition of the training populations that is derived from the whole data set. First, he calculates the mean prediction accuracy of each environment and then ranks them in order of accuracy. Then, starting with the least predictive environment, remove one environment at a time, retrain, and cross-validate the GS model on the remaining training population. This becomes the predictive set. Then you predict the removed data with the GS model, and that is your unpredictive set. Then we can use both accuracy measurements to decide the cutoff point for the number of environments to remove from the data set to maximize the accuracy. This figure just illustrates the results of his analyses of those data sets. Across the x-axis is the number of environments excluded from the training population, and the y-axis is the accuracy of the prediction model. And the group that is taken out is in red. And as you see the accuracy begin to increase, that is where you want to stop, because then you're capturing some of that information that is more predictive, and on the blue dots, that shows your remaining environments and their predictive accuracy. So you can see that it increased from about 0.54 to 0.61 after 18 environments were removed from the training population. So that's another approach to dealing with G by E in these models. Two other graduate students, one Elliot Hefner, who has graduated and now working for Pioneer, started our genomic selection work back in 2007. And his work was involving both biparental populations and genomic selection across multiple families in our wheat breeding program at Cornell. Jessel Rakowski works on genomic selection for disease resistance and recurrent genomic selection. So one of the important considerations when you're getting into doing genomic selection is whether you're going to do predictions based on biparental populations or cross-family populations. And they have pluses and minuses for both. Your biparental predictions are going to be population-specific, obviously, but you can have higher accuracies with smaller population sizes and fewer markers than you can with cross-family predictions. But the advantage to the multifamily prediction is that you can sample more environments, you can build a large training population data set, and because you don't have to retrain your model each each cycle, for each different populations, it allows you to sample more environments and build a very large data set. So there are advantages to both. In my wheat breeding program, it's very typical. We start with a source of variation. We begin our inbreeding with marker-assisted selection for a few loci, and then those are bulked, and single plants are advanced through hedgerows, the screening nursery, and then what we call a master nursery. And from there, we select individuals that go into the regional trials. With the genomic selection superimposed on this breeding program, we can now do early generation genomic selection. And from there, it's just a question of increasing the seed to the point where you have enough seed to do your advanced trials. So we go through a seed increase phase where we can also impose some phenotypic selection. Okay, so in a multifamily prediction, we looked at four different genomic selection models as well as two approaches to association mapping. And this just summarizes the characteristics of those different genomic selection models. We used association analysis with and without the kinship. All right, so it turned out that the association analysis without the kinship was slightly more accurate than with the kinship matrix. The GS models were fairly similar in their accuracy. The genomic selection was 25% more accurate than with the marker-assisted selection, and the phenotypic selection was slightly higher than the marker-assisted selection and the genomic selection, as you would expect. So the highs and lows and the means for the accuracies are shown in the table there. And overall, the Bayes A model happened to be the best in this with this particular data set. This is the relative accuracies of genomic selection over the phenotypic selection accuracy. And this shows, we have eight traits there, and it ranges from a low of 0.84 for heading date all the way up to 1.09 for grain yield. And so you can see that there's a relationship between the relative prediction accuracy and heritability, with phenotypic selection doing relatively better for the high heritability traits, as you might expect. Elliott also calculated a net merit index that integrated 13 agronomic traits, and he calculated three different weightings using both the Bayes selection index and the Smith-Hazel selection index. And averaging across the six merit indices, the genomic selection was actually 14% more accurate than using the phenotypic selection. And so the net merit accuracy for the adjusted genomic selection was over 0.5. Jessica Rakowski is another graduate student working at Cornell with John Luke and I, and she's been looking at two different projects. This happens to be a project on Fusarium head blight resistance. She used cooperative nursery data. This is also a collaboration with Gina Brown-Gadira at North Carolina State University. Those cooperative nursery data included incidence, severity, fusarium damage, kernels, an index based on incidence, severity, and kernel quality, and then dioxide mevalonol, and finally heading date. She looked at four different GS models, and then also association mapping with a kinship matrix. Her training population was relatively small, only 132 and predicting 33, and these were fivefold cross-validations repeated 10 times. This graph shows the relationship between the number of QTL in the multiple linear regression model and for each of the six traits. And using the fixed effects model, the accuracy tended to plateau right around 15 QTL. I just wanted to point out that the red line there is the dioxin of alanol, and it tends to have quite low heritability. And the data for that particular trait are quite limited also. This summarizes the accuracies of the different models. Random forest model came out pretty good on this in this data set. And also the RKHS models work pretty well. And all of these genomic selection models were quite superior to the multiple linear regression. Because dioxin of alanol is so hard to predict, she decided to take a look at correlated traits that might help to predict DON content, the toxin content in the seeds. And it turns out that the incidence and the index and the severity all are pretty good at predicting DON, but the best turned out to be the random forest plus the other traits in an index to predict DON content. Our other project involves genomic selection to improve adult plant resistance to UG99 stem rust resistance. The phenotypes come from the Kenya nursery, and she's using these prediction models in a recurrent genomic selection scheme. So in a recurrent genomic selection scheme shown here, you start with a population that is trained. That is, you get phenotypes in Kenya for the stem rust, and then that population is genotyped. You train your prediction models, and then you can impose selection on your population by calculating the GEBVs. The selected individuals are selfed. The selfed seed is then sent to Kenya to evaluate to see how much gain from selection has been made. Then those materials are recycled into the population, and you update your genomic selection prediction model. This just summarizes the results from her genomic selection models for adult plant resistance. The Bayesian lasso and the ridge regression worked best for this data set, and probably have a little lower risk of overfitting than the random forest model. So I just want to summarize by saying that genomic selection differs from marker-assisted selection and association breeding in that we really don't know the underlying genetic control and the biological function. Breeders can implement genomic selection without the upfront cost of obtaining that information. And genomic selection preserves that creative nature of phenotypic selection that can actually arrive at solutions that we don't expect. But the most important advantage is the reduction in the length of the selection cycle and the associated phenotyping costs, resulting in greater gain per year. Thank you very much.
Mark, we do have time for a couple of questions, so please direct them right to Mark.
Or to Nicola. Yes, in the back.
Hi, Mark.
Oh, hi, Kim. So she combined the trait index with the GEBVs from the random forest. I don't know the exact protocol that she used for that, but maybe John Luke could comment.
Yeah, I think so. Random forest is nice in that you can throw in just any manner of predictor that you want in there. So if you can have a phenotype as predictors along with markers as predictors.
Oh.
And so she built a bigger model. That had the three
multiple locations, or was it a single location? Did you know any of those big environment issues as well?
Right. We're working with three different sets of data. These happen to be the STEMRA screening nurseries that are managed and conducted by CIMMYT. And I believe we have three environments for the second wheat screening nursery, two environments for, I believe it's the candidates of the fifth, and one environment for the fifth. So it's a mixture of multiple environments for different nurseries. It's a total of about 380 lines. Calculate bluffs, yeah. I guess that's it. Thank you very much.
Another question? One more. Since you're up.
So with these different studies, each one seemed to recommend a different set of techniques. Do you feel like you're getting to the point where you can recommend a single one, or do you think that's never going to happen because each situation seems to
Well, it is true that we do see different models. But the model accuracies are not huge. So I think we're kind of settling on Bayesian lasso and ridge regression and I don't know, maybe RKHS and random forest. That probably will capture most of what we want to look at, and John Luke can probably comment on that too.
Invite him up to do so now. Thanks very much.